Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Great to have back VJ Pandian in the studio with us. He's a horticulture agent, educator for UW Extension, and works in Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine County. So he's got a big area to cover there. So we'll talk with him about composting today, winter mulch, and a lot more. Of course, we want to hear from you as well. And we already have a couple of callers online. Linda and Jim, we'll get to you in just a bit here. But what about you? If you have a question or comment, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. VJ Pandian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Compost, let's talk about compost for a minute, and then we'll get to Linda and to Jim.
Sure.
But is this a decent enough time of the year to start composting? Or
I think so. I mean, the leaves are dropping down from the trees,
yeah,
and people are starting to clean up their garden. I think it's a great time to get started with your compost pile. I mean, composting is like an organic goal for gardeners,
yeah,
I would say.
Yeah.
And it takes about 3 to 6 months to get a decent composting. So if you're thinking about for having a compost for next following season in the spring, I think you need to get started with composting right now. Say, start to gather the materials for composting. The brown and the green matters a lot. So the brown usually is the dried leaves, twigs, shredded newspapers. All those things are rich in carbon, and the microbes need those carbon. So gather those things up. The green matters includes your any food scraps, leafy scraps, your chopped up vegetable waste materials. So and including lawn clippings which are not treated with any herbicides. Gather those things. So ideally, you need to have 2 parts of brown matter, 1 part of green matter.
Mm-hmm.
Mix them up together, maybe sprinkle some soil to it if you feel that you don't have enough microbes. And you can get started with your composting in a very simple way. You can use a chicken wire to hold those things, or you can use any kind of like a wooden craters. There are a lot of innovative ways to create your own compost bin. But no matter what, ideally, you need to have a minimum about 3 to 5 cubic yards of volume to get started with the composting. If you don't, probably it'll take a longer time for the materials to decompose.
And tomato plants, too, that are probably gone by the board now could go into that, too, couldn't they?
It depends. A lot of times, tomatoes harbors a lot of diseases.
Oh.
Early blight, septorial leaf spot. If you feel that your tomato has been infested with quite a bit of these kind of blight issues, especially if you're living in central part of Wisconsin where there's some reports about late blight issue, then don't toss those materials into your compost pile. Rather, you bag them up and you trash it. Let it get cooked in a full sun for a week or so, and then you can trash it. And same thing, if you suspect some of the plants that seems to be infested quite a bit with either diseases or something like that, then don't toss those into a compost pile. Larry, I'm a lazy gardener too. I don't want to get up in the middle of the winter to flip those piles, okay? I'm sure there are many gardeners like me too. So, in those kind of cases, I think probably, heavily infested weed seeds or maybe, highly infested disease pathogen, infested plant material, those things could be trashed out.
I was thinking about, when speaking about trash, I was thinking about my own experience last night at about 10 o'clock. I decided that Limey needed to come inside because
uh-huh.
it was getting cold. And I brought Limey in and I grabbed Limey by its trunk. And right over the carpet, the pot separated from, and so I had at 10:30 at night. I'm sweeping up some of the dirt from the pot and putting Limey back together again, and it worked all right. I didn't lose any limes off of her, but
as long as you just don't disturb the root ball quite a bit, that's
I
perfectly
didn't.
Fine.
I think she's going to be just fine.
Yeah,
Kent in Reedstown has something for you. Hi, Kent. Kent, are you there? No. Let's try Kent again. We'll try for you again. Oh, well, that's interesting. Let's go to, because it looks like he's there. Let's go to Linda in Eau Claire then. Linda, hi.
Yes, good morning, Larry and VJ. I have a question for you. We had apple trees and a cherry tree. They were dwarf apple trees. We had them for at least 14, 15 years. And we had to cut them down, and we had the stumps removed. I'm wondering how quickly we can replant trees in that area.
Okay, it depends upon your site condition is. If your site has been fairly clean, which means without any perennial weeds right now, then probably, you know, as soon as next spring, you can plant some other tree species right up there. I mean, you can plant any other type of dwarf apple trees and stuff like that. Now, if you said that you also had some cherry trees, is there any reasons why you cut down the cherry tree? Is it because it has a black knot disease, or is it something for other reasons?
The trunk was splitting, and it didn't have any leaves on it this past year.
No. Okay. Okay.
So in those cases, you know, yes, you know, go ahead and you can plant them next spring. You know, do a little bit of a, you know, research, you know, make sure that the cherry species of cultivar that you're going to select is hardy for Wisconsin. Most of the sweet cherry trees are not hardy for Wisconsin, except if you live in Door County. You know, it gets a lake effect, and it provides you a little bit of, you know, or protection for those cherry trees. If not, you can grow some tart cherries, you know. So, yes, definitely by next spring, you can start planting some new trees.
Linda's in Eau Claire, so you need to kind of watch out about which cherries trees you're planting, for sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. As long as we're on trees, Dave in Bayfield called to ask if he can prune apple trees now.
That's a good question. I mean, it depends upon what type of pruning you're going to do. If you're going to just prune some of the water sprouts right now, yeah, we can do that. You know, water sprouts are exception cases. By late summer, you can thin some of the water sprouts. But if you're going to do some major pruning, you know, probably I would wait till about like late winter, early spring to do those kind of prunings.
So February, somewhere in there maybe?
Probably I'm thinking about like March. So you want to watch out for your temperature should be above freezing. And plus it shouldn't be snowing or raining at the time. So that would be the most ideal time to do.
And Jim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind today?
Well, there's a whole lot on my mind. My question is not so much about composting, although I think probably on public radio 35 years ago, I heard that in wine country in France, they compost the grape seeds in greenhouses to heat the greenhouses.
Yeah, they do.
That sounds like an idea who's come and gone, perhaps. but my question has to do with Creeping Charlie. First of all, I'm curious whether it is a native species, but your screener also mentioned that it made an excellent ground cover, and while I'm mowing the lawn, I look over the neighbor's backyard, which is nothing but Creeping Charlie. It never needs to be mowed, and I believe it has flowers that, of course, are food for some people. My question is, how might I propagate it in my own yard?
Okay. Creepy Charlie is not a native species. It is native to Eurasia. So it belongs in the mint family. So when you touch this Creeping Charlie, you will find an angular stem or a square stem. And when you crush the leaf, it has this kind of like a minty odor to it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, there are two things you need to know. You really need to control Creeping Charlie. You know, you don't want to propagate them. You don't want to actually nourish them. So there are two ways to look into it. If you have a weeds in your lawn, it indicates that your lawn is declining for obviously for a lot of other reasons. Maybe too much shade, your soil is highly compacted, or there's not enough nutrients. So try to figure out why your lawn failed. Quite often, many times these weeds invade your lawn, it's simply because the lawn grass is failed to grow. So you try to find a way or strategy to boost your lawn growth. At the same time, a short-term strategy is like a band-aid strategy is how to control the existing creeping trolley. To do that, unfortunately, you know, organically, you cannot able to do because creeping trolley is a perennial weed. But you can keep trying to spray with some organic product. It just burns a leaf, but it doesn't do any good. So if you feel that way, that you want to go with a conventional way, then you can use a product which has an active ingredient called triclopyr. Now, there are certain brand names, actually, which has been labeled for, you know, oxalis and clover control for turf grass use. You can use those kind of product to control the creeping trolley. I think you may need to spray two times in the fall. Fall is one of the best time because for many perennial weeds, they intake the herbicide as a nutrient and gets to the root system and knocks the plant out. So being said that, that's a conventional way. But if you're more of an organic way, your option is very limited. You can use one of the organic products. Most of the organic products are contact type with just the burns of foliage. Or you can keep on mowing them and until the plant loses its energy.
But now Jim actually wants creeping Charlie. He wants the other. But you say, don't do that, Jim. Don't do that.
No, it's an invasive species.
Okay, so... So there you go. And actually, if you keep your mowing height high, that helps, I think, with creeping Charlie, proper fertilization, keep your lawn growing well, you're going to not have it. So if you want to think about the opposite way, but Vijay says, don't do it. Don't do it. Norman in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Norman.
I've got a question from PJ because he's so good. He seems to have all the answers. We have a small orchard and garden, and one of our problems, particularly this year, but it's a problem every year, is various fungi, everything from scab on some of the varieties of apple trees to various diseases on the stems of the grapes and on the leaves and so forth. And what I've used in the past, I use Captan almost religiously, and then I often use Rubigan, and I used to use Benelate alternating so they didn't become resistant, but Benelate's been pulled from the market. I also use copper soap solution. I'm not sure how effective that is. And then I was told recently that there's a new fungicide, OSO, that's supposed to be next to God in strength, and then I was advised that Rally would be a good systemic fungicide. In other words, I got a variety. I got pears, apples, cherries, plums, and I got a whole bunch of variety of vegetables. Are there any of these that can be used on a variety of them rather than just on a specific plant at a specific time? And then you have to change back and forth between sprayers and cleaning it out and so forth. It becomes almost impossible for a person who has a mixed growth of material as we do.
Yeah.
So, Norman, as much as I like to grow fruit trees, but it's a high-maintenance crop, as you know, okay? And especially this year, with all the rain that we got from the spring until now, it's a wonderful year for fungi. They are having party all over, actually, the fruit trees, okay? And so sometimes, you know, it's hard to prevent these things or even combat them, even if you try to alternate different type of fungicides. So the very first thing, as a gardener, you need to know what type of fungal issues you're dealing with it. You need to be very careful about it. Send the sample to a pathologist to get it tested. Either you're dealing with a scab, you're dealing with anthracnose issues, you're dealing with any kind of leaf spot issues, you're dealing with the brown spot, whatever it is, okay, try to identify correctly. Now, the issue, the key issue is, it's all about timing. Say, when there is a primary infection of this disease is going to take place, you need to spray this fungicide just ahead, a day before that. That fungicide will act like a protective film, preventing those fungal spores, okay, infecting your young leaf tissues. If you miss that crucial time and then come back and later on spray onto it, then it's no matter. It's failure.
Too late.
Too light. So the timing is very key. And I think probably if you miss that crucial timing, then probably in a, no matter what type of fungicide it's going to spray, it's going to be utter failure. So my suggestion is, okay, try to identify, send the sample to Dr. Brian Huddleston, get it tested, and get to know what the specific timing to spray for those things. And that'd be the right way to go.
Yeah, it's more work, Norman, unfortunately, than perhaps other kinds of crops that you might have, almost for sure. Well, Gary in Green Bay coming up next, but just a reminder here, we're talking today with Vijay Pandey, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in a lot of different places right now. He's in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Potratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Vijay Pandey. Great to have him back, and thanks so much for listening in. Give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Gary has a question, I believe, relating to compost. Let's go to Green Bay and talk with Gary. Hi.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Hey, listen, a lot of the villages and cities, they grind up their leaves and they grind up the twigs and stuff, and they mulch them and turn the piles and stuff, and then they give them back to the people. And I was told that you're going to use that mulch, you're going to add some nitrogen to it because it really sucks the nitrogen out of the soil. Is that true? If I get some of that stuff and use it, do I need to add nitrogen, or what do I need to add to it to make it more productive?
So you need to add some green materials in it. So many times the city people, the municipal people, gather all those, you know, dried fallen brown leaves and twigs and stuff like that. And they are rich in carbon. But carbon is not the only one that the microbe needs. They need some little bit of an amino acids for them to grow and, you know, duplicate their cells and stuff like that. So for that, they need nitrogen. So nitrogen basically comes from the green tissue. So if you have any vegetable scraps, if you have a coffee grounds or any leafy green materials, even including like, you know, cow manure, horse manures, you can add those things. Those things will supplement the nitrogen. In the worst case scenarios, if you don't find any green matters, you can also add a sprinkle a little bit of synthetic fertilizers to supplement it too. So those things will spur up the composting process, you know, faster enough. So a lot of time people, if they don't add enough green materials to it, your compost will not heat up. It'll simply stay put. So in those cases, it'll take a longer time, more than a year, for them to completely decompose, okay? So think about adding some in your untreated lawn clippings, you have pulled up all your weeds, okay, which doesn't have gone beyond its flowering phase, or even these vegetable tomatoes or peppers or your potato plants, whatever that you harvested, you're done with the harvesting, you know, you can also put those things, you know, chop them up and put them back into your compost pile.
Kent had called to say his compost pile was ready but not creating heat. Wondered what he was doing wrong, and it's probably what you just talked about.
It basically is. You know, you need, ideally for a composting, you know, the CN, what do you call the carbon nitrogen ratio should be 30:1. Now, what it means is that you need to add 2 parts of brown matter, 1 part of green matter. So if you have, you know, too much of brown matter, not enough green matter, then the pile is simply going to sit. That it's not going to be enough microbes to decompose, and it's not going to generate enough heat. So what I would suggest to Kent is that, you know, put some more green matter into it, either like a leafy vegetable scraps, you know, coffee grounds, or even like, you know, rotten cow manures or dairy cow manures. You can put those things up and then flip the pile into it. So that's one of the primary reasons why in the pile is not heating up. The second reason could be is that sometimes if you not have enough moisture, but this year we have plenty of rain actually, yeah. So I wouldn't worry about that.
Marilyn in Mequon has something relating to compost as well. Hi, Marilyn.
Well, hi. My question is regarding which weeds are okay to add to the compost pile and which to avoid. I know that you can not to add weeds like teasel, garlic mustard, thistle. I'm not so sure about quack rhizomes. you can add those. You don't add those to the compost pile. But which are the what are the general guidelines of which weeds can be added to the compost pile and which not? And is there a reference that you can recommend?
That's a very good question. So when it comes to weeds, the few things are very critical. One, first of all, the weed seeds, okay, shouldn't have passed beyond its flowering phase. Because once it gets to the seed production, okay, once it starts setting the seeds, and what's going to happen is that if you add those in a seeds back into your compost pile, your inner core temperature of the compost pile needs to be at least about 140 degrees Fahrenheit to kill those weed seeds. Now, it's not guaranteed that it's going to completely kill the weed seeds. There are possibilities some of the weed seeds might have a thicker seed coat that could resist too. So you have to be very careful about, you know, any weeds that has passed beyond its flowering phase, I would not add. Now, being said that, don't add any perennial weeds. Perennial weeds, they usually propagate through rhizomes, okay, and are runners. So if you add those rhizomes, including like a quack grass or creeping charlies and those kind of stuff, you know, you pull up all those rhizomes and add those things, that's a good possibility that some of those rhizomes, if I quote myself that I'm a lazy gardener, I'm not going to flip it, some of the rhizomes could be on the periphery of your compost pile and they could easily overwinter for next season, and then you're going to actually spread it back again to your garden. So don't add. So mostly I would recommend annual weeds which has not passed beyond its flowering phase. Now, don't add any invasive weeds. So any invasive weeds like garlic mustard, okay, or your honeysuckles, buckthorns, or any type of woody or herbaceous invasive weeds, all you have to do is to chop them, bag them in a black plastic bag, let it get cooked, and then you landfill it.
There you go. And she also wondered about a publication. Does Extension have something on composting?
Of course, we do have a wonderful publication written by my former horticulture educator, Christy Van, and it is actually in the Learning Store website. So she can go to the Learning Store website and type in composting, and you'll come across that publication.
So the University of Wisconsin Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu, I believe is the site.
Yes, it's a learningstoreextension.wisc.edu.
.wisc.edu. Yeah. That's right. I forgot about that. .wisc.edu. So there you go, Marilyn. And that one, you can just get it online if you want to, or just view it online or make a copy offline with it. Mark in Reedstown, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Larry, and hello to your guest.
Thanks for calling.
Two quick questions. I had a very bad year with my lilac bushes this summer, very few blossoms. And when the blossoms died off, I trimmed them down so that my dad could look out his window and see his chicken coop. And I'm wondering, now that they're getting back up there where they're in his way, when is a good time to prune them again before winter? And my other question is, I planted an asparagus patch and found out that I had planted it right underneath a black walnut. And I'm wondering if that's why it just dwindled off and died. I'll take your answers off the air.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
So the first thing, Mark, is that in a check if the lilacs gets at least about a decent amount of sunlight. Oftentimes, if your lilac has been planted close to a building or underneath the trees, if it doesn't get enough sunlight or less than 5 hours per day, then it won't able to set the flowers, actually. Second of all, since the lilac are spring blossoms, they should be pruned right after they're done with the flowering. So if you start thinking about pruning right now, they already set the flower bed for next spring. So if you prune them right now, you're going to lose the flowers for next spring. So hold on to your pruning tool. Wait till it's done with the blossoms, okay, next spring. Usually it prunes flowers in May to early June. So probably by mid to late June is an ideal time to prune those lilacs.
I should also mention, it sounded to me like he was topping his lilacs, and that is not a good approach, if that's what Mark was doing.
It's possible if you do top them or make a cookie cut, then probably you're also going to lose the flower heads, because most of the flowers are set in the terminal ends, because that's where it gets plenty of light and that's where the flower bud initiation takes place. So for pruning a lilac, there are two types of pruning you need to do. One is called the renewal cut. Another one is called a thinning cut. A renewal cut basically means is that if you have a 6 older canes, okay, and what you have to do in a year, you can take a maximum 2 out of them by cutting all the way down to
right
the ground.
Right at the bottom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is called the renewal cut. And that will free up and enhance some of the new canes to come from the center. Now, the other one, if you're trying to reduce the height of it, you can prune some of the canes from the top and to a close to a lateral bud or close to a lateral branch, okay? And that is called a thinning cut. So let's say your branch height is about like 6 feet high. In a year, you can able to thin or reduce height maximum about like a 2 feet. You can able to take it off from the 6 feet. So being said that, you know, timing is very crucial. Don't prune your lilac right now. It's already set the flower bud for next spring. So wait till after you're done with the blooming next spring, and then you can prune it.
And asparagus and black walnuts.
Of course, asparagus is very sensitive to black walnut toxicity called juglone. So your only option is scoop them out, scoop the crown out, plant them at least 50 feet away from your black walnut tree, if possible. Or maybe get a new crown.
50 feet from the driftline of the tree.
Of course, of the tree. Or maybe get a new set of a crown and plant them differently in a different site location. And make sure that, you know, if you're raking the black walnut leaves or fruits, and don't add them into a compost pile, because juglone could be persistent in the compost pile and you're going to spread it, actually, if you do toss them around your garden. Say, don't add any black walnut leaves, fruit pods, twigs, including poison ivy, too.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks so much for that question. Lori in Green Bay, I think it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hello. Yeah, you had a previous caller who called about propagating Creeping Charlie. Trust me, you do not have to propagate that. It will eventually get to his lawn, and he will never get rid of it. But your guest had said that you shouldn't propagate it because it's an invasive species. But aren't all our lawn grasses invasive species, too? Non-native. And one thing that I found with the Creeping Charlie is at least it flowers. It's good for bees and butterflies to eat off. A couple of springs ago, that was the first thing that flowered, and the bumblebees were all over it. My grass that was exposed, it wasn't doing anything for any wildlife. Plus, we waste so much time and energy and gas mowing lawns and taking care of them, herbicides, pesticides. I think some of these other species may be something that would be a better alternative to grass.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I had a brief chit-chat with Larry about it, too. There is a new concept called flowering lawns. So it's emerging. So, you know, you can intermix your lawn with some clovers and other some type of flowering species to encourage and attract pollinators into your lawn, too. And that's, of course, a totally acceptable. And, nowadays, I think many gardeners are accepting to that new concept of, you know, hey, if you have some weeds, that's perfectly fine. And as long as it blooms and it attracts and being beneficial, that's also perfectly fine, too. Yes.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We have Catherine from Marshfield to say she has a small compost bin under her sink. She's using liners that are supposedly biodegradable. Wonders, what do you think? Is this a true claim? Does she even need the liners? If they're paper.
I never had an experience using liners. I'm not really sure.
I mean, I don't think you need them.
You don't need them at all.
No, you can.
I mean, maybe it's just to hold those in a pile. Maybe it could be possible.
But this is under her sink, so I don't see why she'd need them.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Joy in West Bend. Hi, Joy.
Hi. Thank you. I remember hearing, I think on this program last year, that it's difficult to bring in a rosemary plant. And that's certainly, mine had been moved already and died last year. So this year I bought a rosemary plant in the spring that the seller said would be more likely.
More likely to survive inside. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, what will improve our chances for having our rosemary plant survive? I bring it into the greenhouse. We have a greenhouse that's not heated, but it never freezes in there.
And you get a lot of light.
I do. In the winter, we get a lot of light. There's a tree there, but once the leaves are gone, that greenhouse heats up to like 80, 90 degrees.
Oh.
When it's sunny. And my other question is about bearded iris. Is it too late to dig up some rhizomes, separate them, and replant them?
See, with regarding to your rosemaries, I think it's absolutely, you can bring them back inside in a potted container back inside your home or into a greenhouse. And the key thing to watch if you're having it inside your, in your greenhouse is that during in the wintertime, if the humidity drops down quite a bit, make sure that, the pot is not too dry. So check the soil moisture in the container. And it's always good to, keep it slightly on a dry side, but at the same time not too dry. So water them up, once in a while. And that's a key thing. And second of all, watch out for some of the pests. You might be surprised to see that, what pests could attack, actually, in rosemary in the middle of the wintertime. You'll be amazed to see even some aphids and mites could even attack those things and could also cause a decimation of your rosemary plant, too. So, of course, you can grow them inside. You can overwinter them inside. So keep a close eye on the humidity inside your greenhouse. Now, regarding to your bearded iris, yes, you can. Yeah, you can gamble on it. You can still go ahead and divide them and, plant them in a different site location right now. So the last few years, we're seeing an extended fall season. So perhaps, who knows, this time, we may also have an extended fall season. So you might be in better luck. So go ahead and divide them and see, take a chance. Yeah.
Thanks, Joy. Appreciate the call. Lydia in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Lydia.
Oh, hi. I'm calling. I've just moved to Wisconsin from Twin Cities, and Twin Cities has a very active organic recycling program. Is there anything like that available in my new neighborhood?
I don't know much about in Eau Claire area, but you can contact your local county extension office in Eau Claire, and they may be able to provide some better information about it. I know in other urban areas in Wisconsin, they do have this program on organic recycling programs going on. So I think probably check with your local county office, extension office. They may be able to give you some better answers on that.
Yeah, and stay listening. There may be somebody from Eau Claire will call in and say, oh, yeah, we got that program and tell you about it, Lydia. So stay listening. But your county extension office is going to have some information for you as well. Mona in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Mona.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two Japanese maples. They're about 6 or 7 years old. And this spring, the bark near the ground level, maybe about a foot up from the ground, the bark split, and now the bark is just peeling back. The top of the maple looks fine, but I'm not getting any color. And my other one, I don't have any splitting, but the whole top, bunches of it were just dying off. And again, that one is not getting any color. So I'm wondering, are they worth keeping, or should I just start all over?
So you can certainly blame it on the winter, the previous winter that we had. So this year we've seen a lot of Japanese maple either got tossed quite a bit or they had all this kind of issues of box splits happening up. It's because of the sudden drop in temperature in the previous January that we had, causing all the box split, and the cold air gets inside into it and kills the inner bark. So that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the outer bark peeling off right now. Unfortunately, not much can be done at this time in regarding to your box split. Hopefully, there are some healthy bark surrounding it will able to seal the wound off, and hopefully the tree will recover from the injury. Now, regarding to your other Japanese maple, if the leaves are turning brown and turning wilty and dropping down, and it happened in the middle of the summertime, then probably it could be two reasons. One, it may have some winter injury on the root tissues, causing them to the top of the crown to collapse down. Because during in the midsummer time, when the demand for water level increases up and when the plant has been severely impacted by the root system, they can't even to compensate the support the entire growth. So that could be a reason. The second possibility is that maybe you need to send a sample to our pathologist to get it tested for verticillium wilt. Verticillium wilt sometimes also could mimic like that too. So no matter what, if you don't see any green tissues, cut those things off. Now, be patient. It'll take time for them to color up. And I think probably we're just starting to cool down right now. So hopefully by, end of October, your Japanese maple would be in peak, fall color. So.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Mona. Appreciate the call. And Richard in Oakland, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. I'm calling with a tip for depositing organics in your compost pile or bin in the winter. I have a pretty good sized pile surrounded, of course, by mesh fence and stuff. And I wait for it to get frozen down about a couple of inches. And then I simply dig a hole in the top about a foot across or so and make a kind of a cavern in there. And I put a garbage can lid on it. That way, no matter what happens, I just lift that garbage can lid up and dump my compostables in there all winter long, and job done. I don't have to worry about digging through a frozen compost pile at all.
You're a smart guy, Richard. You're a smart guy.
That's an excellent idea to compost and put the compost pile continuously throughout the winter time. That's a really nice idea.
I like that. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Well, our guest today is Vijay Pandey, and Vijay is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Vijay Pandey, Extension horticulture educator for Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine counties. Great to have him along. We've talked a bit about composting, but taking other questions as well. So if you have a question about your lawn or garden, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Joan in Milwaukee's online, so let's go there. Joan, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. As a gardener, I'm, been really interested and kind of excited about ways that gardeners can help with problems of climate change. Really by planting trees and perennials and also just soil conditioning and soil bacteria, because I've read specifically about this methane sort of eating or, breaking down bacteria that is normally in the soil but is not really in the soil much anymore, which is actually part of the problem with that. And just thinking, and I think this might be just way beyond your guest, although I think he seems to know everything, but maybe there'd be something he might know about this methane thing, like using compost from cows, would that possibly bring it back or that sort of thing? There's been a very interesting video by a somebody from, she's originally African, but she's in California, as Merit Asafal Burhi, about this. So anyway, so I was just wondering.
Okay. Joan, thank you very much. Vijay, are you familiar with this?
I'm not really familiar with that, you know, about the methane oxidizing type of bacteria and microbes, you know, that helps. But there are some studies that has been done, actually, how these type of, you know, bacteria can help in reducing the greenhouse gas effect, you know, especially in this current, you know, age when we are talking quite a bit about the global warming and what kind of environmental steps that can be done and taken to do that. I mean, in the ag side, I'm sure there might be some lot of, you know, research studies might be done about, you know, using these kind of tools of using this in a methane oxidizing type of bacteria to reduce those kind of things. But in the gardening world, in the horticulture world, I'm not really familiar with that on the application side of it. And
I think a good, healthy soil, if you've got a good, healthy soil, you're going to have, I mean, if those bacteria are present, if the soil is good, you're going to have the bacteria. It's probably that person who is, Joan, that you were hearing about, probably is someone who tries to promote good organic soil.
Of course. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, if we do have rich organic matters in our soil, that will really help in promoting a lot of beneficial microbes in our soil. And you don't have to, think about adding any type of, above and beyond any type of synthetic type, you know, to do that. So that will really help us out, you know, in reducing or cut shorting, you know, the need for using some artificial type of fertilizers and stuff like that. So again, as the, you know, the customers also pointed out that, you know, planting more trees and planting more shrubs, you know, also helps quite a bit in reducing this global warming too, because the trees and many of these things are a huge biological sink of all these kind of, you know, carbon dioxides in their system. So I think we need to focus, you know, more on the easier side of planting trees to reduce this global warming effect.
And thanks again for calling, Joan. Deb in Stratford up next. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was wondering, we have a nice strawberry or a raspberry bed, had it for years, and this year we discovered when the fruit, we picked it, and like if I split it open, there are little white bug worms in there.
Hey.
Yeah. So, well, I'm suspecting you might have an infestation of spotted wing Drosophila, which is an invasive fruit fly, in your raspberry fruits. So when you try so when you try to squeeze it, you see those white maggots coming out of it. And even in your raspberry patch, when you walk around to it, you will see these fruit flies in a swarming around to it. It might be too light to do any management, but one thing I would suggest, if your raspberries are mature enough, go ahead and harvest it. Don't let them sit on the, you know, a plant, you know, let it ripen. So when you get to the ripening stage, then probably those fruits get decimated. So harvest them when they are in mature stage and store them right away or process them right away. And in the fall, do a good job in raking all those debris fallen on the ground, because that's where you start to see the eggs of those kind of fruit flies, you know, all those materials laying down. So you can able to remove those old wintering eggs and debris, okay, and do a thorough job in composting it. And in the following season, I would start to set some traps to monitor the infestation of the spotted wing Drosophila. So probably by midsummer or early summer, you know, you can set some apple molasses, you know, things like that, you know, or even a vinegar and in a cup, and try to see if you could able to, you know, trap any spotted wing Drosophila. We have an extension publication that talks in detail about it, how to set this trap. It's a very easy way to do that. But as soon as you cut one spotted wing Drosophila, and then probably you can start thinking about some management. And so there are both conventional and organic management options available to prevent those spotted wing Drosophila adults attacking your raspberry fruit. So check out our UW Extension publication on this invasive spotted wing Drosophila.
So UW Learning, the University of Wisconsin Learning Store, and Drosophila, spotted wing, Drosophila, yeah, and raspberries, and yeah, it's going to come up.
Yep. Yeah. Or you can just type in as invasive fruit fly. It's also going to come up.
It's going to come up then, too. And so you can get planned now and be ready to go next year, yeah, with your raspberries, Deb. Thank you, yeah, so much. And that's something that a lot of people are going to have to deal with. So if you haven't had them yet this year, if you didn't have the worms this year, you might want to just go and get yourself a copy of that publication and be ready to go next year, because they could come next year to your area. Paul in La Crosse, hello.
Hello. When I plant tomatoes, I give some away. And everybody says how good they taste. And my first question was, do the tomatoes you buy at stores, are they bred for looks rather than flavor, like they do with flowers sometimes, bred for looks rather than smell? And I think even apples sometimes bred for looks rather than taste.
Hmm. Okay.
So the tomatoes, every varieties are very different. So when you're thinking about tomatoes, you have the hybrid tomatoes, you have the heritage or the ethnic tomatoes. Most of these hybrid tomatoes that we see, in the market, they are large in size, different colors. And like you said, they look a little bit more fancy, okay, on a side. But, when it comes to taste-wise, it doesn't taste like a typical, heritage tomatoes. So most of these type of heritage tomatoes are bred specifically for flavor purpose. But the heritage tomatoes, if you are a gardener, you're growing those things, you know how much issues it can also cause because of all the diseases it can able to trap compared to the conventional F1 hybrid type tomatoes. But being said that, heritage tomatoes, are one of my favorite choices because of the flavor it has. So, you might be absolutely right that most of
them they're bred to be moved and transported long distances.
And most of them are used for processing purpose too, and so they are more meaty and fleshy, but that doesn't mean that they have enough flavor to it. And most of these hybrid tomatoes, they are more purposes for high yielding, but many a times when you're thinking about heritage types of tomatoes, they're more for quality reason, not for quantity purpose. So
yeah, and in terms of the apples, I had somebody I were talking about that one day, an apple specialist, and I forget the tomato or the apple that was developed in Minnesota that is so popular. I'm forgetting the name of it now off the top of my head. But when it was developed there, it was developed under certain kinds of soil conditions. And the flavor was very, very good under those soil conditions. But then when it's grown, it becomes popular, and then they start growing it in many other areas of the country, maybe where the conditions are not the same, mm-hmm, in terms of soil and everything else. The flavor changes, and sometimes it's not as flavorful as that original,
yep,
that got it going.
Yep, you're absolutely right. The climatic factor also plays a major role too, besides the soil, because it depends upon how much heat unit we have. It depends upon how much cooler weather we have. A lot of times when the apples, when we're thinking about late season apples, we start harvesting by September. But if we wait till about October, the quality or the taste quality,
yeah,
varies. It's more sweeter. Rather than harvesting in September, it's still in the mature stage, but it has a lot of starch in it. But if you wait till about a little bit longer, it has more better quality. So the climatic weather condition also play a key role in determining how much sugar content these apples have.
Yeah, so there's lots going on there, Paul. Did we answer your question? Well, maybe we lost Paul. We probably lost Paul. Sean and Allison emailed. They bought a house. They got the yard full of weeds. How do they get a good lawn going in their new place?
Okay, so if your lawn grass has more than 50% of weeds, or it has more than 50% of dead patches, then maybe it's time to think about doing a complete renovation. So in those kind of scenarios, you need to think about what kind of lawn you want to have. Whether you want to have a high-quality lawn, you want to have a medium-quality lawn, or you want to have a low-quality lawn. Okay. So if you're thinking about a high-quality lawn, but I don't want to do anything to it, then it's going to be an utter failure. So you have to determine, if you do want to have a high-quality lawn, make sure that you invest the proper time and resources to maintain it. But most homeowners prefer a medium to low-quality lawn. To do that, the very first thing is that make sure to assess your site location, how much amount of sunlight you receive in your yard. And if you're going to have a full eight hours of full sun, then probably hooray, you can start with some Kentucky bluegrass and be mixed with some fine fescues. But if it's more of a pot shade, make sure to use fine fescues. But there are certain grass species which are absolutely low maintenance, like tall fescue. You can also think about that, too.
Yeah, and there's some publications in the learningstore.uwex.edu that will tell you all about growing a healthy lawn. VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine counties, our guest on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller.
Learn, taste, and make at Fermentation Fest in Reedsburg, October 5th and 6th and 12th and 13th. From interactive art to sauerkraut, celebrate live culture in all its meanings. WPR is pleased to support food, the arts, and agriculture. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today as we visit with VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine counties. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sam in Madison has a question for you, VJ, so let's go there. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Larry. Hi, VJ. I've been making an observation about the relationship between plants that are being stressed and fruit production. And I'm a small-scale grower, and so the blossom end rot, say, is stressing the plant, and it's producing this fruit, and albeit it's kind of premature. And likewise, there's this chemical called paclobutrazole that outside of the U.S. is used to stress fruit trees and puts the energy into the fruit, and it becomes a larger bounty. So maybe you can tell me about what I'm observing with stress and the production of fruits and vegetables, and how maybe as an organic grower we can use this observation more beneficially.
So, for a plant to grow, any kind of like a stress, like either it could be a moisture stress, too much moisture or very little moisture, or it could be any other environmental factors like a heat stress, okay, or even a root injury, okay, or lack of nutrients can all, add stress to the plant. So when a plant is in a stressful condition, few things that you can observe on a plant. This is more a general one. One, probably, either they get into a little bit of a panic mode, especially like in a perennial plants like trees and stuff, like, it seems like a climatic stress going on. Maybe, you know, I need to start producing more fruits or seed so that my progeny could thrive. So they will get into that stress mode, and sometimes they will start to see they are producing enough number of fruits. But that's one exceptional case. But on the other hand, most of the annual plants, sometimes when they get into the stressful situation, they will stop producing flowers or fruits because that's the last thing they want, because to produce a flowers and fruits, it takes enormous amount of energy from the plant. So the comment about this blossom end rot, it's totally different. The difference is that the blossom end rot is triggered by calcium, so the nutrient calcium. So it doesn't mean that the calcium is not enough in the soil. There's plenty of calcium in the southern part of the Wisconsin states. So it's a matter of the calcium is not being properly circulated in the plant system. And so the calcium is not getting enough into the fruits, and that's why it's causing this blossom end rot, okay? But that stress is not actually going to impact quite a bit, you know, on the growth, but it'll impact on the first or second set of the fruits, okay? So make sure to add some enough moisture, make the plants, you know, the soil moist condition so that the calcium gets properly circulated into the system. Now, regarding the paclobutrazole, that's your comment that you made. So paclobutrazole is a hormone type. So if a plant is already in a stressful condition, they use this paclobutrazole hormones, okay, to relieve the plant of their stress symptoms. So I really don't know the exact science behind to it, but I do see that sometimes the paclobutrazole is reduced to shorten the height of the plant or to regenerate the root system. So if you have a root injury on the plant, to regenerate those things. Or if a plant is going already in a stressful condition, they use those hormone stuff. So the complication of the stress is that it differs from plant species to plant species. And there are a lot of factors that causes a plant to trigger the stress. So it's, pretty naive to hypothesize all these things by saying, giving a general comment about it, by saying, stress could actually trigger more fruit production, or it could impact too much on the growth. It's because it varies, and it varies based on what type of stress you have, and it varies on species by species too. So, yeah.
I was thinking about somebody on the show once who called in and said he takes a baseball bat sometimes to his fruit trees and whacks them a couple of times to get to stress them. Uh-huh. And then someone else talked about even making a partial incision in the tree trunk itself.
Yeah. Our former UW Extension specialist, Dr. Terry Roper, recommended this technique. So if your fruit trees, hasn't able to bear any flowers for more than about like 7-8 years and still looks healthy and you have enough pollinations going on, pollinated trees you have, still it doesn't able to produce your apples or pear, then probably, like Larry, you said that you can make an incision, intentional stress onto the tree in the springtime by peeling on a certain section of the bark of the tree. And that will help them to trigger the flowers too. But there are certain stress. The climatic stress could change your plant its own sex. Yeah. For example, the ginkgo is a very good example. So we are planting male ginkgo trees in our landscape, the popular one cultivar like, Autumn Brilliance and things like that. So under a stressful condition of 3-4 years, either due to heat stress, moisture stress, okay, a male ginkgo could change its sex to females. So that's also possible.
That's also possible. I want to go back to that email from Sean and Allison from Madison. They asked about lawns, but they also wanted to start composting. They have plenty of leaves, no green matter since they have no lawn or garden. But they do drink coffee. Could they use coffee grounds alone as green matter? And do we need a third of our compost to be coffee grounds, or are they more potent than other green matter because they would be, that would be a lot of coffee grounds.
Certainly, that'll be a lot of coffee grounds if you just want to use a coffee grounds in it to consider as a green matter. So coffee grounds usually has about like a 2% of nitrogen, the used coffee grounds, and they are not tend to be acidic, you know. So, but rather I would also encourage them to add other green matter to it besides a coffee ground, you know, to spur up the composting process to, with that.
Yes. Or in a, and if you just simply don't have any, then you probably have to go to a little commercial fertilizer, a little nitrogen in there. Or
yes, you can use actually in a rotten cow manure or something like that to as a substitute. You know, you can also use those things.
Anne in Racine County, thanks for calling.
Hi there, guys. Thanks for the show. It's a great show today.
Thanks.
About 2 years ago, I had a ginkgo tree volunteer. And it's right against the foundation of my house. And it survived a couple winters, and now it's about 2 foot tall. And I'm looking at it thinking, it's really pretty. I'd really like to rescue it, but it shouldn't be against the foundation. And everything I'm reading on it says transplanting should happen in the early spring while it's still dormant. So any words of wisdom you've got for me?
Okay. This is a very tricky question because you need to know the sex of the ginkgo. So, because that is a ginkgo is a dioecious, which means they have a male ginkgo plant and a female ginkgo plant. Generally in the landscape, we don't plant female ginkgo plant because the fruit of the ginkgo has this kind of pungent odor and once it becomes mature and I don't know how pleasing it's going to be in your landscape if you have that, you know, fruits falling in your sidewalk or driveway. So being said that, if you don't care about those things, yeah, probably early spring is one of the best time to scoop it out. I mean, when you try to scoop it up as much as possible, the roots, you know, along with the soil, the close by, you know, and scoop out the entire root ball as much as possible, and then you can able to transplant it. I mean, the roots of the ginkgos are pretty resilient. You know, even if there are some few feeder roots have been damaged, don't worry about it. It'll take some time to readapt to the new site location to do it. But don't do it right now. So do it, wait till about like in early spring. But as I said, you know, you need to know the sex of the ginkgo. To know the sex of the ginkgo, there is no magic way. You need to wait at least 15 years or so to wait for, to figure it out. So it's a risk that you're going to take.
There you go, Anne. And if 15 years down the road, you see it's a female,
you can enjoy for the first 15 years, and then maybe you can say, yeah, that's fine. You know, you can coexist with it, you know.
Irene in Lake Mills, we'll go to you next. Hi, Irene.
Hello. Thank you. I have very tall hickory trees, and they're hanging over my house. I'm wondering if you can trim branches and the tops of hickory trees with them continuing to grow and not killing them.
Yes, you can trim them, but, you know, I would encourage you to contact a professional arborist. So when you're thinking about, you know, trimming a large size tree, okay, it's best and safe to contact a professional arborist, okay, who are certified under the International Society of Arboriculture, so that they can able to assess the tree, you know, branching structures, and then they can able to trim them, you know, in the later part of, during in the dormant season, either in late spring, late winter or early spring. And they can make a proper pruning cut, and they have, you know, the liability insurance and all those kind of stuff. So pruning a large-sized tree by a homeowner could be very tricky because of that. So I would highly encourage you to contact a professional arborist. You can go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association. Go to Google and type in Wisconsin Arborist Association, and you will be able to find in their website a professional list of professional certified arborists for the state of Wisconsin. And you can choose one of them which are close by to your area and contact them.
Yeah, you're in Lake Mills. There's plenty then within a short drive from Lake Mills, and maybe some right in Lake Mills. So that is the best advice you can have, is to have somebody else to do the pruning. But it wouldn't hurt to call now and even schedule for later on. Mm-hmm. So you're in the person's, whoever it is, you're in their calendar.
Exactly. I mean, this is a busy time for many arborists. So call them right away. and schedule an appointment to do this pruning in the winter time. And maybe it's not a bad idea. Ask them to come down right now to take a look and assess the tree's health and see how the branching structure looks like. And is it safe to prune this particular branch, you know? And is there any other things that you can assess on the trees, any crack or split on the trees, you know? And how hazardous it's going to be, because if the tree is way too close to the foundation of your house, and if the tree is leaning or not leaning, you know, all those things could be assessed right now. And then, you know, ask them to do the pruning probably in mid to late winter.
There we go, Irene. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too. Hey, we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You know, I was talking about that Minnesota apple, and I couldn't remember the name of it. And so Sharon in Berlin, thanks for calling back and tell me it's a Honeycrisp. Mm-hmm. That's an apple that if it's grown in Minnesota under those conditions, they're absolutely delicious. And some they lack a lot of flavor in when they're grown in other areas, as far as I'm concerned, in anyway. So there you have it. So soil testing, I don't know that we've talked about that yet. Is now a good time to do some soil testing?
Absolutely. I think this is a perfect time to do a soil testing. So as in about a couple of weeks when the soil starts to dry out, you know, from all the rain that we got. And once you start cleaning up your garden, it is the best time to gather some, you know, good representative soils, okay, from your garden. You know, you clean up all the mulch and go to 1 to 6 inches into your soil and scoop up some of those coarse soils and collect randomly about 5 to 10 coarse samples in your garden and mix them all together in a single bucket and then bring one or two cups to your local extension office to get it tested. So the reason, the idea behind doing a soil testing in fall is that in fall, when you test the soil and get to know the results, so you can actually amend your soil right away in the fall. Let's say your soil is lagging behind, being too alkaline and needs to be acidified. You can apply the elemental sulfur right away in the fall. It takes 3 to 6 months for the sulfur to break down. So by next spring, you know, it'll be good to go. So knowing ahead the lack of nutrients in your soil that you have, you can able to have a head start in your garden for the next season, and you can start, you know, prepping your soil right away, and you can start planting in spring. The other biggest advantage is that right now, you know, if you do a soil test, you can get the report, you know, within
quickly.
10 business days at the maximum. But in spring, everyone is rushing to get the soil test done. It may take 2 to 3 weeks, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Pam in La Crosse, thank you for calling.
Hello there. Good afternoon. I want to go back to the raspberry bushes.
Okay.
I have a raspberry patch, and it exploded this year. It went well beyond the confines of where I want the raspberries to go. First of all, I'm wondering how I can keep that within the confines of the raspberry patch. I'm going to have to cut those all back or down.
Yeah.
It depends upon what type of raspberries you have. Generally, we are speaking about we have a summer-bearing raspberries and we are having a fall-bearing raspberries. The pruning for these two things are absolutely different. Say, do you know what time of the year they are fall-bearing? So the fall-bearing is very simple. Say, once the ground starts to freeze, take a lawnmower and chop them all the canes down to the ground. Okay, and then if you feel that some of the canes are suckering up from the ground and going above and beyond your confined area, you take a shovel and chop them down actually to the ground. Okay, say for fall bearing raspberries, very simple, mow them down to the ground and then take a shovel and chop some of those suckering canes that's coming up from the ground, okay, that's extending above and beyond your confined area, and keep them down, limited to whatever the confined area that you have.
Yeah. Can you put in a barrier, a plastic barrier around to keep the spread?
You can do that. You can certainly do that. My best suggestion is that train your raspberries.
Yeah.
You know, put up a trellis system, you know. In that way, it would make the life of you very much easier. I know it's a pain to set it up, but once you set those things up, then probably it will look nice and tidy. And then you know exactly, you know, to what extent you may have to chop those suckering canes off, you know. And
Good idea.
I think that would be the best route I would suggest to do.
There you go, Pam. Thank you. Catherine in Madison, hello.
Hi. I have a Rose of Sharon plant that's about 2.5 feet high, and it's in a pot. And I'm wondering if it's too late now to plant it in the ground, or if I should somehow try to keep it until spring. And do you have any words of wisdom on that?
I always take a little bit of a conservative approach on this. So if you have it in your pot, I would find a very protective landscape spot in your yard, right underneath the tree, a little bit away from the western winds, protected by a row of tree or a shrub, and dig a hole or a trench and bury the container. And add a little extra soil on top of it, about 3-4 inches above it, and then once the ground starts to freeze up, I would put up a chicken wire around to it to protect from the bunnies. Okay, and then in the next spring, then you can scoop the container out, and then you find the ideal spot that you want to plant your Rose of Sharon, and I would plant it.
Makes a lot of sense to me. Keep it right in the pot, Catherine, for now. Appreciate your call very much. Winter mulch. What about winter mulching? What do we need to do?
For the last couple of years, our winter temperature has been fluctuating back and forth. And, so as we start to think about, when the soil is about to freeze, what happens is that, the temperatures start to plummet quite a bit down. Once the temperature starts dropping down quite a bit, it actually kills the roots of many of the plant, especially herbaceous perennials, fruit trees, and many of those things. So to prevent all this fluctuating winter temperature impacting the root zone of your fruit trees, your perennials, the winter mulching is absolutely necessary. You can use a wood chips. You can use any kind of like a sawdust. You can use any of your straw or something like that. So once the ground is close to getting to a freeze, spread those wood chips, extra layers of wood chips, okay, about like 6 inches, okay, deep, around your root zone areas of your fruit trees, your herbaceous perennials, okay, as an extra layer of blanket. So last winter, in specific, we didn't have enough snow cover until like late in January.
Yeah.
So if we happen to add some winter mulch like in mid to late December, we wouldn't have lost quite a bit of many of the herbaceous perennials or many of your Japanese maples, have been succumbed to this winter temperature injury. So having this winter mulch is absolutely necessary. It's a good precaution. The only downside is that when you start adding too much winter mulch, okay, it may also house in voles. So make sure to protect your trunk of a trees, with a chicken wire or any kind of hardware cloth with about 1/4 inch in wire mesh or less. And then probably in spring, you can rake them back again, those wood chip mulch, and use it for other purpose.
And on that note, we are out of time, VJ. I want to thank you so much for coming by and being with us today. We'll look forward to another visit.
Sure. Thank you. Absolutely.
VJ Pandey, an horticulture educator for UW Extension. He's in Milwaukee, in Kenosha, and Racine counties. Always great to have him come by, and he'll be back, and we'll talk with him again for sure. On Monday's show, we'll be finding humor in the dairy state. Steve Hanna will be with us to talk about his new book, Dairylandia. It's hilarious in parts. And we'll also talk to the creators and stars of a new web series. It's called A Dairy Tale. So I hope you can join us for that as well. I've been looking at the segments, and there's some pretty funny pieces in them, and I'm looking forward to talking to them as well. In the meantime, there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.
right through the afternoon, so I hope you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.